Welcome to The Rolldown. This podcast is for people of color who need a space to be known and seen, and guidance for those who are in the pursuit of justice. We are your hosts, Alethea Lamberson
and Matthew Melendres. It's good to be here with y'all. This is our second series in our first season. This series is called In the Valley. And so a lot of you know that Alethea and I both are people of faith. We believe in God and we believe in scripture and we look to scripture to guide us. And Psalm 23 is one that has ministered to us both tremendously through hard times. And part of that passage, it says, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me. God is with us." And we know and recognize that every person will be in a dark valley at some point, whether it be short or long or something that affects the rest of our lives. It can take the form of chronic illness, death, unfulfilled dreams, oppression, abuse, and many other things. Valleys are really a journey, and we want to talk about what we feel are some important topics that can be helpful wherever you are in your valley, especially for those who are pursuing justice. There will be many, many of these valleys. And so we had the opportunity of hearing from Emma with the first episode of Suffering and God. And then we got to hear from Dr. Soon-Chan Ra on Lament and Justice. This episode will be focusing on joy and rest. And then the last episode will focus on perseverance. And so we have been honored to put this series together. And I am especially honored by who we have today joining us. Alethea, can you let us know who's with us?
Oh, yes. Thanks for the privilege to welcome Cole Arthur Riley to the Rolldown podcast. Y'all, I'm so excited that Cole is with us. Trying not to fangirl too much, you know? But let me read Cole's bio and then we'll get into it. So Cole Arthur Riley is a writer, liturgist, speaker, seeking a deeply contemplative life marked by embodiment and emotion. She is a founder and writer of Black Liturgies on IG, Twitter. Hopefully you know about Black Liturgies. Black Liturgies is a project seeking to integrate concepts of dignity, lament, rage, justice, rest, and liberation with the practice of written prayer. She currently serves as a content and spiritual formation manager for a Center for Christian Studies at Cornell University called Chesterton House. In her work, she produces and curates content to guide others into deeper musings and embodiment of the faith. At present, Cole is concerned with topics of dignity, lament, belonging, justice, rest, and liberation. Some thinkers who have formed her include James Baldwin, Thomas Merton, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Julian of Norwich. Cole, welcome to the Rolldown.
Thanks for having me. So glad to be here.
All right, Cole.
Oh my gosh.
Let's get into it. We got a lot of fun things to talk about today, but
real quick though, I just remember we shared this before, but I remember I think we had an Instagram live or something with Tyler Burns, and he had talked about, he referenced you, Cole, and he said, you know, Black Liturgies, like, if you're not following Black Liturgies, what are you doing with your life?
Pretty much.
And so that's what we have to say as we start. If you're not following Cole and Black Liturgies, what are you doing with your life?
Pretty much. Part of my daily routine. So thanks, Cole, for that. But yeah, so before we get into what we're going to talk about today, Cole, would just love to know, 2021 has been a lot, okay? So someone said back in January, you know, everyone was like, oh, 2021, like, you know, 2020 was a hot mess. 2021 was gonna be so much better. And someone said on Twitter, really, 2021 is just 2020 with a wig on. And I was like, wow.
Yep.
That feels pretty accurate. So how have you been doing the last few months? I mean, that's a loaded question, but whatever you'd want to share with our listeners. Yeah, how have you been navigating these days of 2021 so far?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I've been doing okay, just okay. I'm actually immunocompromised. My husband and I, we've been completely secluded for over a year. We actually just calculated that in the past year, we have been with other people in person a total of 5 times. So it's really just been us, which is wild. But I've been very fortunate to be in a home that's safe and a home with enough food and access. And we purchased a house with a bit of land. So we've been able to explore that and be in our bodies, which has been good for my soul in a lot of isolation.
Amen.
Yeah.
Goodness. I don't even know how to, you know, comprehend some of that just with the depth of isolation and grateful that y'all have been able to persevere in the midst of that so long now. You know, we thought this wouldn't last as long as it has, and it unfortunately has been pretty long, but grateful that you're here, you know, and like you said, just doing okay. And that's where I think a lot of people are. I'm there, you know, I feel like some days hanging on by a thread mm-hmm. at times. So thanks for sharing that with how you're doing. So as Matthew gave our little intro in our series In the Valley, we want to talk about in this episode with you, Cole, on joy and rest while in the valley. And I feel like you capture a lot of this in your writings through Black liturgies. I've noticed that quite a bit, even the post this morning that I read, you know, so rich. But would love to know, before we jump into more of the focus on joy and rest, like, where, how did Black liturgies come to be, first and foremost? I know it hasn't been around very long. And then we'd love to hear, like, what prompts you in the midst of all that's been going on? What prompts you to post, you know, as frequently as you do?
Mm-hmm. So I'm a writer. I've always been more drawn to written expression since the time I was little. My father really encouraged my sister and I to read and write a lot. And so in becoming Christian, I found myself quickly drawn to the beauty and language of the Episcopal Anglican tradition, the liturgy and the Book of Common Prayer. And I still am, but I'll say there are seasons when it becomes particularly difficult to pray words written by mm-hmm. a white man.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wake of the murders of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd and the resurfacing of the murders of Breonna Taylor and Elijah McClain,
mm-hmm.
I found myself very quickly in one of those seasons where mm-hmm. I just needed a prayer expression that spoke to my Blackness, to Black emotion, to Black thought, Black belonging and liberation in a unique way. And so Black liturgies was born. But it's become a really healing habit to, I wake up, I don't prepare the post days in advance. It has become a really daily practice for me to rise and attune myself to whatever is stirring in me. And then I write either something that I'm processing or reading personally, something from a conversation or a moment with a Black friend, or something the country is holding at that particular moment.
Wow. That's incredible. Like, it's not, like you said, it's not something you do days in advance. It's like that morning, that day. And what paying attention, like you said, being attuned to yourself. I think about last summer, when I feel like I have the space to do that, and how traumatic it was. And I don't even remember how I came across. I think one of my friends had posted on their page or on their story, you know, this Black liturgies prayer. And I was like, oh, what is this? You know, so I click on it. I'm like, man, this is like spot on. And then it quickly, you know, started following you. And then it was like post after post. So I was like, wow, Colt, like, this is engaging my heart, engaging my soul in a really significant way. You're giving me words as a Black woman experiencing so much pain and trauma of, like, I was having a hard time praying. I was having a hard time engaging with God. I got tired of saying, how long, oh Lord, you know? So what are mm-hmm. other ways to be able to express the anguish, the pain, the anger? And I feel like for me, you were capturing so much of that over the summer and have continued to as well. But it's incredible to see what God has birthed out of such pain. I think about Tyler Burns. You know, we've already talked about Tyler a couple of times. I know you recently were on the Pass the Mic podcast, but was listening mm-hmm. to his talk at the Culture Summit, the Q Ideas conference that he just spoke at. And he was talking about being a Black Christian, and, you know, and just talking about what gets birth out of our pain and our trauma. Like, we're so much more than those things. And so, mm-hmm. I'm grateful for you and leaning into that and seeing what God has birthed out of such something that's been so traumatic, and then how it's been so healing. I can speak, I feel like, for a lot of other Black people as I'm engaged with other friends, how your words have been impactful and so helpful for us in the last year.
Thank you.
I think around the same time, maybe we had the mutual friend that we both saw post, and it just, and I think you're right. I think there's so much beauty in certain words that, like, I know you said how there's just certain seasons where you don't want to read from a white man and their prayers, and you creating that, I think a lot of people were in that space last summer and still are, but just to have something written by a Black woman that it's so deep and rich and just raw. And I just think that combination, I think, is very rare and almost be in process too. And I think that's one thing I love about your posts. It's not these conclusive and kind of tied up with the bow. Like, and I think that's so much of what, like, American Christianity is. Like, everything has to finish on a certain point and make you feel a certain way and to kind of still leave you in the waiting. You know, that sometimes your post, it doesn't necessarily take away the pain, but it gives words and language to sit in that Saturday, you know, and to sit there in that holy Saturday of the waiting, and you can't see the light. You can't see what's going to be good from this, but you're there. And just the language, I think, honestly, that can be so healing and breaks these chains of isolation and confusion, not even to be able to get language. And so I just so appreciate, you know, not even being Black, but I think as a person of color, many people of color who are not Black have been so blessed by your work. And so just thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Thank you for allowing the world to see your heart and your soul and the things that you're processing and the things that you're hurting. And it has been a tremendous blessing.
Thank you so much. Thanks for naming that and for holding my words with such nuance. It really touches me to hear that you're able to perceive some of the things that I was intending, and even things that I wasn't intending, but that I so appreciate and want my liturgies to contain, as far as, like, the rawness and the lack of a conclusion or a teaching moment. So yeah, I appreciate you naming that, you both.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you ever, you know, I will reference one of the people that was influential for me about 10 years ago is Henry Nouwen. And I think that, like, especially his book, The Inner Voice of Love, I'm not sure if either of you've ever read it, but it's his personal journal through the darkest season of his life. And it's almost like these liturgies, these half paragraph, you know, paragraph. And I was like, some of his paragraphs are more impactful than entire books I've read. And it just is that, like, raw, here's my soul. And again, I just think when I read that, it's just like, it's so courageous to let people into the rawness of the soul, like the tensions of the soul. And so I think that's what it kind of reminded me of, but in a very new and unique way, different way, that's so needed. Because, like you said, most of these things, even the kind of more traditional liturgy type things, have been predominantly from white men. And so I think that was something that it added to that kind of the way that it pulls and tugs on my soul. And very few writers have the ability to do that, at least for me. And I would say Henry Nouwen and you. So, you know, we are talking about joy and rest. And so, Cole, as you think about joy and rest, and how those point to hope in the midst of the valley, like, can you just speak on that? Like, how does joy and rest help as we're in these seasons of suffering and seasons of the valley? What does joy and rest look like for you?
I think it's vital as we think about the valley. I so appreciate that this series has been based around Psalm 23, and that passage, you know, though I walk through the valley, it's just so well known and used a lot in art and film, which I love, but it's been used so much that it's easy to become numb to particular parts of it. And I have this friend, Tommy, and our friend group we're all pretty socially conscious, justice oriented. And so we'll all be chilling, doing something, talking about some policy or new tragedy. And Tommy, his, like, thing is when he's done, he'll just be like, "All right, y'all, he makes me lie down," and then, like, we'll just leave. And it's like this joke, "He makes me lie down." And he's been saying this since I've known him. But last year, at some point, it just hit me, like, that's where that passage is from. Psalm 23, like that's where that line is from. He makes me lie down. And how strange is it that in the midst of tragedy, in this psalm, in the midst of the psalmist's tragedy, God's answer or God's primary attunement seems to be to our bodies. Like, it's all very sensory. He makes me lie down. He leads me beside quiet waters. And later, you prepare a table for me. Mm. There's a remark on where we'll dwell. And so it's this embodied experience of salvation. It's an embodied experience of rest and liberation. So when I think about the valley, this psalm has absolutely formed my concepts of rest and staying in our bodies in the midst of tragedy.
Whoa.
I've heard so many sermons and talks on Psalm 23. As you mentioned, right, we reference it all the time. I have never heard anyone talk about Psalm 23 like that. Mm. Ever.
Same. Mm. Yeah, I've read books on Psalm 23 and everything, and just that embodiment part, like, you know, the ways that it can help us embody our experience of salvation and justice. I just so appreciate that because of the small details. Like, it almost shows how much God cares about the most fine details of, like, our experience from a sensory standpoint, which, again, it almost then points, like, if he cares about those small details, how much more does he care about our souls and the ways that that is what he's trying to provide for us in the midst of those times. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, even just as we're there, would you mind even maybe sharing a part of your story where you experienced that in a very tangible way, where you kind of had to fight for that or really trust God in that kind of embodiment in a time of tragedy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, I mentioned that I'm immunocompromised, and so we've been on a very severe lockdown in my household. And I've, when I was 26, and I'm now 30, I began having a lot of health issues. It's been 4 years and I've been diagnosed with a litany of neurological disorders, a lot of autoimmune conditions, but we've been unable to pinpoint what's really happening. So, I'm just becoming used to naming that I'm a person that suffers with chronic illness. And that's been such a strange thing to admit to myself. But when I became sick, I'm a person who tends to exist in my mind a lot, even from the time I was young. And when I became sick, I really began to rely a lot on my intellectualism, on the life of the mind in order to connect with God, in order to connect with other people, instead of diving into the tragedies and traumas that were occurring in my body. I sit in front of you now, and so it probably seems strange for me to say, but like, there were seasons where I couldn't tie my own shoes. My husband was feeding me my meals. And in order to deal with that, my response was to become disembodied, abandon my body as a way of coping, of healing. And it's not unique to me, by the way. It's not unusual. There's so much research coming out yearly about how trauma, including chronic illness, including racial trauma, affects the body. Mm. How something like shame can literally rest on a person's body to transform their posture over time. Wow. And we, for a while, have understood like the patterns of dissociating from the body in the present of trauma. And that can sometimes be a good thing, of course, as a means of survival. But when you stay there, it becomes really dangerous, I think, not just to our physical self, but to our full spiritual self as well. And so it's been a long journey, if I'm honest, a long journey of making peace with certain parts of my body that no longer operate in the way that I've known them, that no longer feel like they are my own, but declaring love and declaring love and embrace over them, and telling myself habitually that I'm not going to leave, like I'm done leaving my physical self behind, and that God does not desire that for me at all. I'll leave it at that.
Wow. I have a hard time finding the words. Cole, thanks. First and foremost for opening up like that and sharing that with not just obviously us, but with anyone who's going to listen to this episode. Just appreciate your willingness to be that vulnerable and to invite us into that. But I think just some of the things that you named, like I don't know how many of our listeners have chronic illness, whether they have it or family members, but I'm already imagining as you were speaking, like how this is going to speak to certain people that, again, we didn't even think about, right, as we were even preparing this episode. But the ways that racial trauma, as we're learning more about that, or like you said, shame, how that affects us and our desire. I want to be disembodied. There's so much where I want to be like, I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to feel it. So how can I just stay in my head? How can I disconnect and just mentally check out, not respond, not deal with it? And so I just appreciate what you've named, what you said you've been willing to accept, because you said God wouldn't want you to disconnect from parts of who you are, you know, but what a journey that's been, like you said, for the last 4 years. So I just, I feel like I'm in awe a little bit of your faith, of your understanding of who you are. And like you said, the embodiment of these things versus wanting to disconnect or dissociate from yourself, when it's kind of hard to do that when you're a physical body, you know? How do you lean into that in the midst of the valley? Like I think about, though I walk through the valley, like we're going to, you know? And so recognizing that makes me think of what our friend Emma said in our first episode, when she says that the last 5 years of her life have been the hardest for her. And so she's like, I've pitched a tent in the valley. That's where I'm at. Like, I'm just, the valley is there. Not, I don't know if I'm walking, I'm just living in the valley. But her willingness to lean into some of that, and I'm just resonating with some of what you just shared too. So, wow.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing about Emma and what she said about that. And almost like when it feels like that's the new normal. Like we pitched a tent in the valley, and then God takes us and takes us to even deeper valleys. And I think that's why even we recognize in our intro was, for some reason, some people experience really short seasons of suffering, some long. And I think chronic illness and death are some of the ones that it's like there's no end, whether it's your own body or someone who you really love, and the ways that the toll that it takes on you over time. And then you talk about chronic illness and death within communities of color, because then you add, like you said, the whole racial and generational trauma component, and it just gets so convoluted. I know that's been my journey the last 5 years, is dealing with my mom's stage 4 cancer while also dealing with all the racial trauma and spiritual abuse. And I think part of the ways that I recognized that I needed a break or that I needed some space is that my body was so out of whack. And just like my back and my head and my neck just were so locked up. And sometimes it would take 3 or 4 weeks because I would go to a massage therapist through my chiropractor, and they would take like 3 or 4 weeks to get my back on, like to get the flare up down. And people are like, oh, massage sounds good. I'm like, no, it's like it gets me in tears because it's all this work on my back because of the ways that, like you said, like we want to abandon our body. I've never heard that before, ever. I'm in a psych program and I've never heard that. Like, thank you so much, just the ways that you give words to that. And so you kind of touched on it in that as far as your chronic illness, but maybe another question is like, when you start recognizing that you're abandoning your body, let's say in the fight for justice or the last couple months that have been a hot mess, how do you recognize that? And then how do you kind of come back? Like, what are some practical ways that you kind of reprioritize and kind of become more have a more embodied experience of your faith during that time? Like, what does that look like for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great question. I think paying attention to how you communicate with your body, which maybe sounds strange. The neuroscientists would have a probably better language, but what kinds of things are, it gives you a clue as to if you're leaving your body behind. Like, what kinds of things are you saying to your hands? What are you saying to, to your jaw? Or what are you saying to your breath? And not literally saying, of course, but like, are you in communication? If there's no communication, I think it's a pretty profound answer of like, how connected are you to your body if you are never in communication with it or never tuning yourself to it? So my first question is like, what kind of things am I saying to myself about my physical self? When my hands aren't, I have trouble with fine motor movements, and when my hands aren't operating with the precision that I'm used to, am I saying like, God, take these hands from me? Or like, if you only could like free me from these hands, am I trying to be liberated from my body? Or am I saying like, God, meet me in my body? Like my hands aren't working the way I know them to. Will you help me to love them? Because it's hard to love them. It's hard to love my hands right now. Wow. I want them to do something. They don't have the strength to do them. Will you help me to rest? And so that communication and attunement, I think, is essential. And once I realized that I had left my body behind, I'm writing a book, and I don't know if this will make it into the book, but in my manuscript, at least, I tell this story of when I had just been released from the Cleveland Clinic, and they had been doing all this testing, and we had a trip planned to Paris, which is a long story, but by the time I got to Paris, my legs and they just weren't working the way I'd known them to work. It was very painful. I ended up needing a wheelchair for most of that trip. I went to the Louvre and saw more butts than paintings because I was lower than everyone else. And it was just a really difficult time. And it was in Paris. I had to lay in bed for 2 days of the trip because my body was in pain, and I was praying aloud to God, and as I was praying, becoming aware of how I was speaking about myself and how I was speaking about my legs and what my actual desire was. And long story short, it made me to realize, like, let's reattune, let's love, let's embrace. And I began, I don't know, in the Episcopal and Anglican tradition, there's this habit of passing the peace that happens before the Eucharist. And I began passing the peace to different aspects of my body, which might sound very dramatic or like poetic, but I did. Like, I touched my hands and I said, peace, peace of Christ. Wow. I touched my legs and I said, peace of Christ. And it's this, in the liturgy, it's this moment where typically you're passing the peace to your neighbor, and it's a moment of reconciliation before you come before Christ and receive the bread and wine together. And I had that moment of reconciliation with these different parts of my body. So that's just a peek into like an initial practice, but of course, I think like ongoing habits of connecting emotion to embodied experiences, like, okay, you're angry. How can you attach an embodied experience to that anger? Whether that's screaming or, I don't know, people who like working out. That's not me. But how can you attach an embodied experience to your sadness? So it's not just existing in a siloed like mental experience. Does that make sense?
Oh yes. I'm like taking notes right now, and I need to evaluate my whole life after this episode,
pretty much.
But yeah.
Very much. I think I'm more disembodied than I will admit, so this
I know
is,
I'm like
feeling very convicted.
Don't pull on that thread right now as we're talking.
And we've had to be, right?
Like, yeah,
yeah.
That's part of how we've survived. Mm-hmm. Like, we're all people of color. My husband, he's white, and when we first got married, he was really surprised when I would forget to eat. And it'd be sundown, and I'd be like, darn, I forgot to eat today. And he'd be like, what in the world? And it occurred to me, like, he didn't understand that we're so used to forgetting our bodies as a form of survival and emotional coping that it's hard to just, like, flip the switch and be attuned, because every time we attune, it's a risk to us as people of color. It's frightening to be attuned to our bodies at times.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just feel like there's so many layers to what prevents us from that. You know, part of it, like, there's shame, there's cultural things, there's oppression. And I think one of the ways I see oppression even play out on this is how much people, a lot of times white evangelicals in particular, a lot of times they're trying to police and dictate how we process our grief and how we process our suffering. And even how you said to attach screaming and sadness to our body, because that's probably the most appropriate and ways that our body's going to be attuned to. But how often in many spaces, especially as Black and brown people, are we, if we do that in a communal space that's a white evangelical space, or how that would be spoken against, that our character and our maturity and all that will be put in a question. And so even, like, do we even have the spaces, even if we are cognizant and aware and want to practice a more embodied faith and experience with God and valleys, do we have the surrounding, of what surrounds us, does it allow us to be attuned to our bodies? Or is there all this regulation and parameters in which what suffering can look like? And so that's just some of the things I've been thinking of as far as, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk about from a person, people of color perspective, what suffering in the valley looks like, because communities of color grieve and process these things so different. You know, it's not better, it's just different. It's sometimes it's public, it's long, it's and some people say dramatic, but I say it's appropriate, an appropriate response when you have chronic illness, when you go with your husband to Paris and you have to be in bed for 2 days. It's appropriate to be angry and sad and pissed and in tears about that. You know, it's appropriate for me with my mom. It's so all these different things. I just so appreciate just this call to really attune and take care of our bodies. And I really appreciate where you've led us so far in this episode.
Yeah. You know, Cole, there's so much that strikes me about what you were just sharing. But one of the things that I'm sitting with right now is the way you have invited God into that. One, you recognize, like, some of the examples you gave of how you were talking to yourself, right? And so I try to tell myself this and other friends too, when I hear some of the ways they talk to themselves, like, be kind to yourself, you know? It's so easy for us to extend those words, but that's some of what I'm sensing is, like, being kind to yourself and then inviting God into that, right? It's very painful physically, emotionally, mentally for you, some of the things that you've shared, but then how you invite God into that. And it feels like it slows you and slows us down enough to then be aware of how have I been disembodied? What are the ways I've been talking to myself that have been negative or mad at my body, mad at my hands for not working a certain way, you know? And then, you know, as I'm kind of thinking about it, when we think about rest in the valley, right? So in the midst of that, it's like, if I can be attuned to my body, not be disembodied, maybe it is I need to actually just slow down and rest, or I need to let that out so my body, the tension in my body can release. You know, you said, I think it was like attaching what we're feeling to an embodied experience, right? So you're like, maybe you need to scream or something. And I was like, well, my stress ball is, like, right over here. That's what I pick up now when I'm just angry and I have to let that out, because I can just sit with that and try to wish it away or just move past it because I got to get through this meeting. And it's like, no, I got to get this out some way. So right now I just need to squeeze the mess out of this stress ball. And then when the meeting's over, I'm going to get up and I'm going to throw it against the wall until I feel like I've gotten it out. And then I can feel that release from my body. Right. One of my friends got me into yoga, and I publicly admitted that in one of our prior episodes. So it feels okay to share now. And never thought I'd be a yoga person. But I recognize I'm more attuned to my body and I feel mm-hmm. the tension. I feel how my body's holding it. And so how do I rest in the midst of that? I need to let that out. And so yoga slows me down. Mm-hmm. I disconnect from everything else. I'm breathing. Like I think about your breath prayers, like I'm breathing and I feel the tension release from my body. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. Now I maybe can think a little bit about what I'm going to eat. Because when I don't do that, when I am so like disconnected, I forget to eat or I can't even think of what to eat. Like I've made meals, I've got stuff to cook and I'm like, I can't even think what to put together right now. Like it feels so, I have decision fatigue, right? Like I'm, but I need to feed myself, you know? And so, but I just love all the things you're connecting. I feel like that's what I'm connecting the dots in ways I feel like I haven't before. You're giving language for certain things, I think, for so many of us in the midst of sharing your own story, which is painful. So again, I just want to thank you for, again, inviting us into those spaces that you may not always share publicly. So thanks for that. Also excited for your book. So that's fun.
100%.
Yeah. So I think just kind of adding on to some of what you've already talked about and what we've kind of hit on, right? The 2021 tragedy after tragedy, you know, we have a whole attempted coup insurrection at the Capitol and continued violence to Black and brown bodies and then gaslighting in the midst of that and trials and verdicts. There's so much has happened that just... For me, like it's just felt hopeless. That's one of the things I think when your words that you share daily have actually helped me cling to hope in some ways at times, but it does feel hopeless in the midst of that. So just I'm wondering for you, how do you, in the midst of all the trauma that we've experienced even in this year, in the last few months, like how do you lean into joy and rest in the midst of all of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It just feels like so much tragedy is around us and it's truly exhausting. And because we're in this pandemic and we're so often confined to our screens relationally, our awareness of it is increasing more and more. And so we just have increasing access to tragedy after tragedy, which I think we absolutely need to contend with. But as we think about joy and rest in seasons like this, you know, on a week when Andrew Brown is murdered, on a week when Makia Bryant is murdered, I think it's important to remind ourselves that joy and rest are not distractions from the tragedy, but they're actually paths through it. Ooh. I think it's easy to feel, you know, guilty for resting, guilty for laughing or amplifying, you know, Black joy in a time like this, but it's actually, I think at least, no small act of resistance in a world that consistently diminishes our humanity to Black trauma, in a world that consumes our pain or is only interested in us when we're, you know, on the concrete crying out for our mothers. Like, we have to resist this consumption by staying whole, by being in our bodies and allowing ourselves a full emotional expression, which includes joy. And then to recognize that rest and joy aren't practices that, you know, that just reinvigorate us for the work of justice, but like practically they are justice and liberation in and of themselves. Ooh. Like in a world where Breonna Taylor was not allowed to rest or to sleep in peace without the violence of white supremacy, like me resting my eyes, Alethea, You sleeping for 8 hours, like that is an act of resistance. Trisha Hersey, who's an activist and performing artist, she names this regularly on her page, The Nap Ministry. Like rest is resistance.
Yep.
It's a holy defiance. Like laughter can be a holy defiance.
Ooh.
Every time you share, it's like we're both speechless. I
need to take it in. That's one of the things with the podcast. It's like we're in the moment and it's like, I just gonna sit with what this person just shared because my mind is blown, or you named something. And so just couldn't take notes fast enough, but talking about how joy and rest are not a distraction. They're a pathway through the trauma that we're experiencing, especially because we have access to so much more, you know, every single day, every moment, you know, and just how that how that can shift us in a significant way, right? Of seeing them as pathways through and not feeling bad. Like I feel like recently seeing, you know, so many of us have, it's like, I need to share some Black joy for myself. Mm-hmm. I've seen people on Twitter say, can y'all share some pictures of Black joy? I just need to see other yes. Black people laughing and having fun and just being human. Mm-hmm. Because social media and the news wants to dehumanize us every second of every hour. And I'm like, yes, like, and this isn't bad, you know, but I feel that tension sometimes, like, can we share this? And it's like, no, we need to, you know, we need mm-hmm. to. And so just recognizing it, it's not a distraction from the trauma, but it's a pathway through it, and how much we need both of those. Mm-hmm. So good, Cole, so good.
Yeah.
I think the Matthew took more notes than I did. I saw you writing.
Yeah, it's not a distraction, but it's the pathway, and also the guilt for resting. And as you're sharing this, it's, I feel like I'm also identifying why I struggle with rest and joy. And it reminded me, I had a really great mentorship that I was a part of with Lisa Sharon Harper a couple years ago. And one of the times it was kind of this embodied session, like she was kind of walking me through and how I'm posturing and just like, and she was asking me questions in the process. And one of the things we were talking through was, I had this visual of, you know, for those who are familiar with Ephesians, when it talks about the armor of God. And one of the things I recognized through the help of some other readings was that three of the pieces of the armor of God are permanent and three are situational. And so the whole armor is not meant to be on at all times.
Wow.
And so I think it's like the breastplate, the shoes, and the belt are permanent, like they're kind of locked in. But then even the verbiage of like take on, put on, and it was like, if you read it, there's like almost different verbs when it comes to the different six pieces of the armor. And so the sword, the shield, and the helmet, I believe those are the ones that are put on, are to take on or take up, I think, and as opposed to put on. And I just remember thinking, okay, like I feel like I live my life like I have my sword with me at all times, mm-hmm. and the shield and my helmet. And like I sleep with it. Like almost like a soldier, like sleeps with their gun, like they're like, and almost when they even come back, like they're not even in war anymore, but they just don't know how. Mm. And I just started crying of like, this is how I feel like I'm living my life. Mm-hmm. I'm always with my sword. I'm always with my helmet. And there's times where like I'm like, oh, maybe I should. And it's like a very conscious decision and like processing sometimes even with my wife, where I'm like, okay, I'm gonna let my guard down in this environment. Like I literally had to work myself to let my guard down. And then what sucks is that half the time, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have let my guard down, because then this happened, this was said, this, and so then it almost solidifies. It's like, it's not this irrational fear, but it's like, where can I go? I was in a parking lot like a year ago, and my wife is feeding her son, and some white woman was next to us and starts ranting all this racist stuff to a cop about brown people. And I'm like, I'm just in a parking lot just trying to feed our son. I can't escape it.
Yeah.
And so I think how I would identify, or how I would, the language I would put to why I struggle is, joy and rest feel vulnerable.
Yes.
It almost feels naive. Like, is it real? Can we really rest? Mm-hmm. Can we really find joy?
Yeah.
And so I don't know if you ever experienced that, but this is for our listeners, but also for me, but like as someone who in my more darker moments, I literally, like, I will say this to my, like, it's just naive to think that we can rest from this. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, yeah, like, what do you have to, like, can you just speak to that? Like that fear of being taken advantage of, or experiencing more oppression if we prioritize rest and joy.
Yeah. I think that's so beautiful. It's beautiful and hard, what you're naming. And it's making me think of, I had a neuro-optometrist appointment recently. Part of my issues are with my eyes. And so she was explaining to me that my eyes were in kind of like a stress response mode. She's like, your eyes are showing me that the part of your nervous system which is activated right now is the fight or flight response, is this wow. like hyper energized response. Mm-hmm. And so she couldn't get my eyes to center for very long. They would just, my point of vision would just drift outward as if there was a threat, as if, like, that's what your body's supposed to do when you encounter a threat. And so it was just so fascinating, but made me realize, like, there are things happening to my body that are actually preventing me from resting, kind of what you're articulating, Matthew. Like, you go to sleep with the sword, you know,
yeah.
because we've been conditioned to understand that we're not safe. Like, it's not safe. I going into a grocery store, that's not safe. Mm-hmm. Nothing, when you live in bodies like ours, nothing is neutral, you know? Mm-hmm. I guess mm-hmm. when you live in bodies, period, nothing is neutral, but especially for us. And so I think it's really good to name that sometimes it feels really foolish and mm-hmm. That it's a risk. It's a risk yes. to us to rest.
Yep.
It's something that not everyone has, like, equitable access to.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone has the time to, like, sleep for 8 hours a day because of the injustices and oppression of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's good to, like, hold all of these things in tension while recognizing that what you're worthy of, like, what you feel safe to do, it's good to name. But then also, like, what were you meant for is just as good to name, to kind of combat that very valid fear of violence, physical, yeah. emotional of violence, to combat that with, yeah, I'm not safe, but I'm meant to be able to X, Y, and Z. And I don't know if that makes sense, but
being
able
does.
To
yeah.
counter that with some yeah. like, but this is what the promise is, and this is where I don't feel like it's being met in this moment. I think it's good for us to hold those things in tension.
Wow. Yeah. And I remember a couple years ago too, I was talking with Christina Cleveland, and she said something so profound of almost like, even within our pain, the way that white supremacy, like the ways that white supremacy is so ingrained into all of our minds, and ways that we still discover over time, and the ways that, and so even within our pain, we're conditioned to, like, until a white man validates my pain, then, like, it's not truly going to be able to experience healing and all that. And she was like, but the Holy Spirit is in us, and the Holy Spirit should be able to validate our experiences and our emotions. So that's kind of reminding me of that, of it's like this self-validation, self-compassion, and like, taking away this, like, oh, this is not irrational. Like, this is actually very rational.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, I'm recognizing I have a choice, and to the best that I can, it feels risky. You put words to it again, like risky, foolish. And I think, okay, but still, like, and it may make the valleys even darker, because it's like almost if I come out of the valley by having joy and rest, it makes the crash even harder. But I just feel like I'm trying to regulate all the emotions, like, and it's even some of the stuff that Brené Brown talks about. Like, if you try to push away pain and grief and tragedy, you push away joy and love and peace. And so it's like, it's so true. And so I just thank you for speaking into that, as I'm just in process of learning what it looks like to take care of my body and to see it as not a distraction, but as the pathway.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, Cole, that was so good. It's okay. You know, I think kind of what you're, the permission we need to give ourselves, right? And to acknowledge, name the things, they're there, they're present, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't, like, be aware of what's there. If we can rest, if we can step away, if we can experience joy, that it's okay to do that while acknowledging other people don't have that type of privilege, right? And so, anyways, just the nuance that's present there, the both and that's present, and how necessary that is. And so, you know, as a Black woman, I would just love to ask you, you know, how, for you, as I think about even just the recent experiences for you personally, but then also for us collectively here in the U.S., how has this been significant for you, thinking about joy and rest in the midst of all that's been going on for you, like I said, personally, and what we've been walking through, and what feel like really dark days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me personally, I don't think there's anyone that who knows me who would say that, you know, happiness is a defining characteristic of me. I tend to just be a more solemn person. I also, in college, was diagnosed with depression. I'm no stranger to sadness, is essentially what I'm trying to say. And what I've had to learn in this season is that joy is more than just positive emotion. It's more than positivity. I think I, for a long time, had this caricature of joy in my mind, of thinking that it was dependent on positivity or happiness, when in fact, I think there's a lot of evidence in scripture that joy allows for sorrow. You know, I'm thinking of Ezra. So the prophet Ezra tells this beautiful story, never gets told. I wish it would. Hopefully from here on out, there will be some listeners who will tell it. But the prophet Ezra tells about when a number of the Israelites during the exile are permitted to begin rebuilding the temple again. And when the builders lay the foundations of the temple, a lot of the priests, you know, they have their trumpets and they're singing and they're shouting for joy and banging cymbals. But it also says that there was a group of older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple, who had remembered its destruction, and they wept. They wept aloud. And Ezra says that no one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of the wailing.
Wow.
And that the sound was heard very far away. And I just think, like, this is one of the most poignant portraits of joy I think we have in scripture. A joy that's not grounded in, you know, toxic positivity, but a joy that remembers, that has memory, and still weeps and allows, you know, for some to shout and sing, and be happy. Happiness isn't a bad thing, by the way, but also allows others to wail and to exist in a memory while looking toward what's coming. And so that's the portrait of joy I've had to kind of reclaim to say, I can participate in this. Like, am I going to be someone who's necessarily singing when the temple's rebuilt? Like, no, I'm probably not going to be that person. And that's okay. I don't need to be. Ooh. And it can experience joy in the way that makes sense for me.
Wow.
I couldn't even take notes during that.
That's why we get to go back and listen. It's fine. I've never heard anyone talk about Psalm 23 the way that you did. I've never heard any sermon, any talk on Ezra and what you just, the picture you just painted for us from that, the way you captured joy. I've never heard anyone talk about it that way. I often say that joy and sorrow coexist. They run on parallel tracks. A lot of people say that, right? And so both, they can coexist, right? But the way you just broke down what, for you, what joy looks like, and again, the permission to say, joy might look like that, might look like singing and shouting and dancing and praising, and that's good, but that's not the only way that joy is captured. Joy can also look like this. That is profound. To me, it's very profound. So thanks for, pointing us to Ezra. I'm like, I need to go read that as soon as we're done with this and sit with that for a little bit. But I just think there's so much beauty in what you just shared, and then how that has applied to you. And just, again, for you to be able to lean into that and say, this is a way I can express joy, and it's okay, and it's good. So rich. Yeah. Goodness.
Just that, we can't distinguish the wailing and the shouts for joy. And just, what Alethea just said as far as like joy and sorrow are parallel tracks. I think about the cross. And how it, I almost sometimes I wish that there was a more balanced way that we speak about the cross. Like, we're talking about, why do we call it Good Friday when, and when it was like this day was horrific as far as what happened, and overly applying like a toxic positivity. And because I think that's what I would think, you know, I think of someone who's super positive or joyful, I think of like a 7 Enneagram or something, like who's always the life of the party.
Yeah.
And who's not a, you know, who I'm too, I think more just very attuned to what's going on in the world and my family. And so I definitely have more of a somber posture. And sometimes I feel guilty about that. Like, am I just this Debbie Downer everywhere I go? Mm-hmm. But just the way that you kind of show like the beauty of those who maybe carry that heavier burden more often than others, and just that there's still ways to experience joy and to live out joy that doesn't have to look like this caricature, like you said, but it looks like from a deep place within, like almost like going back to Psalm 23, in that valley, the moment that we realize that though it may not be over, but God is with us. And in that, like you said at the beginning, like he's with us, like that does bring joy. Mm-hmm. Like it's almost like this relief and purpose of not being alone. And that would bring me joy. It doesn't take away at all from the sufferings that we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I just think you're giving both of us and those who are listening so much permission. And so even at just to be where we're at. And so as we start wrapping up this amazing, deep episode, you know, our the people that we think of as we create these episodes are people of color and those who are pursuing justice. And so if you can just, your last thoughts as far as joy and rest and for people of color and joy and rest for those who are pursuing justice, like what would you want to say to those groups?
I think I'd want to say that I need you. I think I heard someone say this once, so don't credit this to me, but like, I need you in order to get to be free. Like I need you. My freedom depends on your freedom. Like I'm not going to get free by anyone else's bondage. So you overworking yourself, you exhausting your body and abandoning your body in order to try to help some justice objective, in order to bring about wholeness in the world, if you're doing that by neglecting your body, by ignoring the joy that you contain, it is counterproductive. And yeah, that's what I want to say. I need your freedom. I need your rest in order to get free myself. And that helps me, that kind of like mutuality, belonging-centered mindset, that helps me when I'm taking up rest and joy myself.
That was so good. Cole, I wish we could talk. I feel like I could just keep talking to you forever, because even the sound of your voice, I'm like, gosh, it's so soothing. And then you're saying these really deep, profound thoughts. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Thank you so much, Cole.
Yes.
Just for all that you shared, the time. I can imagine you are a very busy person. And so Matthew and I, like we said, we feel very honored to get time with you. But want to share with our listeners, how can they follow your work? Obviously, we gave this shout multiple plugs for Instagram. But what are other ways that, people can follow your work?
Yeah, you're welcome to find me on Facebook at Black Liturgist and on Twitter at Black Liturgist. But if you're not a social media person, you can go to my website, blackliturgist.com, where you can sign up to receive breath prayers and blog posts and other updates. So would love to stay connected to you.
Yeah, awesome. We'll make sure to include that in our footnotes. So you can just, those who are listening, you can just go to the footnotes and we'll include the website. And yeah, so just thank you so much. I've learned so much about not just joy and rest, but about myself. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think there's even some ways I need to reevaluate some stuff. But thank you so much for, I think that you said it when we asked about kind of how did Black liturgies come about, and just like the creativity with words, like you just, the ways that you put words together and phrase things, it's literally breaking the chains and bondage and bringing freedom, and just how you ended it right there. It's so true. Like your freedom. I need your freedom. I need your joy. I need your rest. So thank you.
Amen.
So this is the third episode in our series, In the Valley, and we are looking forward to dropping the fourth and last part of the series. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the other episodes, please, you don't want to miss it. Emma and Dr. Soonchan Ra throw down on those episodes, so take a listen to those. The Real Down podcast is part of the Chasing Justice podcast network. To find out more, visit chasingjustice.com. Please rate and review us on Spotify and Apple and share this with your friends. You can find us on Instagram at The Real Down Podcast. And as usual, we want to thank our team, Caleb, Jaslyn, Cameron, Alex, Emma. Thanks for everything you do to make this work. We want to thank you for listening to The Roll Down.